Fantastic news about vacations. But as you mentioned, the numbers, which I understand are about 100 people last year, are still nothing compared to, say, 20 or 30 years ago. In this context, is the Bishops' Conference open to having a conversation about mandatory celibacy in the priesthood, given that this is something that Pope Francis has said that he's open to having at least conversation about?
I haven't heard Pope Francis say that. I understand he had an individual conversation with one bishop, but that's not been... we haven't received no account of that conversation. From my point of view, celibacy is a great gift in the life of the Latin Church. It's an important signal of a person's total devotion and gift of self to Christ in the ministry of the priesthood, and I think it will remain a great important and enriching quality in the life of the Church. Christopher might be able to add, from those who come forward, I don't have any sense at that time in their lives, and some are, you know, people who have lived complex lives, that the requirement of celibacy is something which it puts them off. I think they too understand that this pathway of priesthood, this main pathway, the pattern in the Latin Church, is a gift for which they pray and which they to which they hope they'll be faithful. Now, clearly there are exceptions. Exceptions are made, but I imagine those exceptions will continue. But I am quite sure that the star that shines in the life of a celibate priest through his struggles is a very important enrichment in the life of the Church. Christopher?
Yeah, I'd add two things to that. Firstly, it's one of my joys to meet regularly with the vocations directors of other Christian denominations who, of course, don't have mandatory celibacy. And they, too, have experienced a sharp decline in the number of those entering the ministry. So, you know, it doesn't solve all of those problems. And secondly, you'll notice that perhaps one of the most striking increases in recent years has been entry to religious orders. And while you could debate, as we know, within the Catholic tradition about, you know, or the ordination of married men or not within the Eastern Catholic Church, for example, you know, members of religious orders are not married by definition. It's one of the things I had to explain to my mother quite carefully. That monks are always monks. We can't have married monks and so on. And I think that too is telling. So I think that the issue of celibacy is obviously an important issue to consider. But the signs are that it is not the universal solution to the problem of ministry that some people sometimes speak as if it was going to be.
Madeline T. I'm from the Catholic Herald. I think my question is for you, Father Jamieson. In terms of fostering a culture of discernment, is it not the case that we have to look at sort of a radical change in our process of catechesis from an earlier age? For example, I heard about a parish in Wales that they're preparing candidates for confirmation by allocating them a spiritual director rather than the rather old-fashioned model of 11-year-olds going for catechesis and being rushed through a programme. And they have to prove that they're really committed to that sacrament and show that through 2 years of discernment before they go through that process. Is that something that you would look at, sort of radically overhauling the way in which we catechise children, teenagers, and surely, therefore, starting that culture of discernment a lot earlier and encouraging a culture of discernment and vocation?
I don't know the details of the particular example you give, so if we might just put that to one side for a moment, I think there is no question that the Church in general is on a journey towards understanding what a culture of vocation might mean in practice. I think, for example, a number of dioceses have their education departments now focused on it. I'm thinking particularly the Archdiocese of Birmingham, where the education department was, I thought, really very ahead in this regard. And they asked me to work with them some 3 years ago, and we did a lot of work, so that they have now started, for example, talking of the Great War before we even came to the commemoration of the Great War. They'd got their history departments thinking, how do we get young people thinking about vocation early on? And they had devised the notion of when they were studying World War I for GCSE, we put in a unit on military chaplains in World War I. There's a very good example of taking this broader approach right into the heart of the curriculum. And I think that there's no question that gradually, I think schools are getting the idea that every young person has to be invited to reflect on their vocation. I think schools are a key part with young people. Secondly, I think parishes, I agree. My ambition, which I find it very hard to get anybody to take me seriously because they think this is so outrageous, but my ambition is that in however many years' time, it will be unthinkable, just as it's unthinkable now, that there is no CAFOD group or equivalent, that there's no outreach SVP to the poor and the needy in parishes and deaneries. So it will be unthinkable that there is not some group or other in the parish devoted to helping young people discover their vocation. I think it's got, and you're right, it's got to become embedded that way. I'm hesitating to comment on the specific example because I don't know. But whatever way a parish finds that young people grow up knowing that the church is a place they can go, the place they can go, to discover the answer to that beautiful question Pope Benedict posed at Twickenham, what kind of a person would you really like to be? And I think it's so beautiful that he posed that to the young people in that very simple way. And I'd hope that every parish will have some process, individual spiritual guidance, groups or whatever, to help people. And see, this is a key part of our mission as the church.
And now you know why Father Christopher is in the position that he's in.
Thanks. Liz from the tablet. You visited Corpus Christi Catholic College while you were in Leeds. Can you talk a little bit about what was involved in that visit and what you did?
Well, Archbishop Malcolm and myself went to visit the school. What we did not want was, you know, a publicised or a public visit. What's very important to the school in these days is that it carries on its normal life as best as possible. And that's what we saw. We saw a school that was getting on, being a big secondary school, and trying to get embedded into its normal routines. We also saw, obviously, it was a school that had been through a really terrible trauma. And there were lots of expressions around the school, spaces where the children were invited to give expression to their feelings and their thoughts at this time. So the main hall was full of stickers and little banners where children were being invited to say what they wanted to say. And I was very impressed when they talked about how the drama department and the art department were very conscious now of their role in helping children to express what was deepest within them. There was also a display of the letters and the emails that the school had received so that everybody within the school could note, as it were, the expressions of support from a wide, wide range of well-wishers, those who wanted to share in the terrible tragedy that had happened. I was very impressed that the director and deputy director of Leeds City Education Authority, or Children's Services, I think it's called now, were both there. And that spoke volumes of the robust partnership between the Catholic community and the local authority. And both of those officials spoke very warmly of the impact that the faith of Corpus Christi had made on them and on the way in which the children and the staff were living through this experience. And I think what I wanted to thank the school for was the witness that they're giving to a Catholic way of understanding and facing death as a reality in our lives, no matter how it arrives, and knowing what it means and what the invitation is and what lies beyond, and why we can face death in the eye and not, as it were, hide away from it. So I was very moved to hear students speak of how grateful they were that the school had opened the following day, because they knew that was their best place to be in each other's company where that faith is shared and expressed, and where they would receive support. And the group of children I sat and talked with, well, up to fifth formers, were very eloquent about their praise for the staff, and they were very clear that what now was uppermost in their hearts, as well as the trauma of what they'd witnessed, was their determination to do what, in their phrase, Miss would have wanted them to do, what Mrs. Anne Maguire would have asked of them. So for one girl, it was to get the best possible GCSEs, especially in Spanish. For another, it was to be very clear about their vocation, what they wanted to do with their lives. One lad said, Mrs. Maguire was fantastic because she never tried to force aspirations on us, but she wanted to know what was most important to us and then would do everything to help us to achieve what we wanted. So there was a great love for Anne Maguire. There was a great admiration for her. There was a huge sense of loss, and I think the school and everybody knows that's going to take a long, long time to live through. But there was, as we've seen, a school, a primary school, and a church, all next to each other, and all speaking of the cohesiveness of the Catholic community. And as Archbishop McMahon said when we came back to Leeds, if you ever wanted a demonstration of the lasting values of Catholic education, then go to that school. And this was something about which I think we can feel very proud, that here were children having gone through a real trauma and a school community, they had not lost their poise because they were standing on the rock of faith and they had great trust in their faith in the Lord, who would see them through, accompany them on this difficult journey. John?
Can I ask also about your discussions on assisted suicide?
Sure.
Did you discuss the those hard cases, which are often sort of thrown up as examples of why we should change the law, some say? And what was the... What was the general feeling about how you respond to those sorts of cases?
We obviously didn't talk about names in particular cases, but it's perfectly clear that the argument that does gain ground in today's society is the argument about personal autonomy and freedom of choice. And I think our reflections on that would be to want to emphasize again and again that no person is totally autonomous. Shakespeare put it very simply, no man is an island. And the decisions that any individual makes have impact, not just on those around them, but slowly on the whole of the land. And therefore, you know, we wanted to say, that notion of autonomous, separate individualism, claiming its freedom, does not generate happiness among us. And what we wanted to draw attention to much more is those families especially who, out of love, care for their elderly. They care willingly. They care not without great stress and strain and difficulty, and I'm glad to see the proposals for more assistance for people who are exercising care. But it's that fabric of the bonds between us which ultimately assisting people to commit suicide undermines.
Thank you.